The only reason to paint over a symbol like that would be to hide the tank's origin, which meant that these were Soviet tanks, not GDR. Everything they tried to present was an image of joyful, voluntary communism. The East Germans aren't trying to flee, they're happy here. But 20 Soviet tanks blocking the border would make that lie even harder to believe, so they hid them behind a thin coat of paint. Even the soldiers manning them wore black, unmarked uniforms. Were they Soviet as well? The thought made him sick. The East Germans were prisoners in their own country, kept here by hostile foreign soldiers, using an excuse so flimsy they didn't even dare to acknowledge their own actions. Reed kept walking past American soldiers and German officers and silent, stony-faced men who could only be Soviet soldiers. One of the East Germans bore a Stasi symbol on his uniform. He looked up, saw Reed, and broke off from his conversation to start walking toward him. Reed angled to the side, cursing his bad leg, and reached a group of Americans just 3 short steps before the Stasi.
"I'm American," he whispered. "Get me out of here."
"Excuse me," said the Stasi man loudly. "I do not believe that you belong here."
"Mr. Banner,"
said one of the soldiers and shook Reed's hand firmly, diving straight into the deception as if he'd been expecting it.
"We've been looking for you."
"Sorry,"
said Reed, letting as much of his American accent come through as possible.
"I had to check on some things. Did you know these are Soviet tanks?"
"They belong to the Deutsche Demokratische Republik," said the Stasi man. "Who are you?"
"Mr. Banner's one of our diplomats," said the soldier.
"He was looking at the tanks for us."
He gestured to the south, toward the American side of the wall.
"Let's get your report back to the captain, okay?"
They started walking, the American soldiers forming an impenetrable perimeter around Reed. The Stasi officer watched them go with a grim frown.
"Who are you, really?"
asked the American soldier quietly.
"CIA,
said Reed, and pointed at his limping foot.
"Undercover mission went bad. I'm going to need a car and a phone."
What he really needed was a medic. But he didn't have time for that. He had to get to Prinzenstrasse 93D to find Ostertag's handler as quickly as he could. And he had to get backup first. He didn't know what the cabin thought of him. They were as likely to throw him in jail as help him. But it was a chance he had to take. He couldn't do this on his own.
"The phone we can do," said the soldier. "Our vehicles are all kind of busy right now. This is a matter of..."
Reed paused. There was one more Stasi officer between them and West Berlin, and Reed fell silent as he approached, not wanting to give anything away. The officer heard them, turned to face them, and Reed's entire world seemed to stop. The man had a face so immediately familiar that Reed lost his breath, staring at the man in shock. It was Hans Novak, Dietrich Boom, Agent Longshore in the flesh. 1,000 thoughts and emotions warred in Reed's mind. Every Stasi agent in the city was here, they'd said. Reed had known it and acknowledged it, but he hadn't considered the implications. First, that this was the man who'd sent him a message every day or so for months. The man whose mind Reed had come to know so intimately he felt like a brother. Davis had called it a kinship, and Reed could feel that kinship now, a bond so strong it was all he could do not to shake his hand or embrace him. But this was also the man who'd accused Reed of treason, and judging by the shocked look on his face, he had recognized Reed and knew who he was. He knew that this was the man he'd been told by the KGB itself was a secret Stasi agent infiltrating the CIA. Dietrich knew, or thought he knew, that right here, right in front of him, a Stasi traitor was fooling yet another group of hapless Western soldiers.
a vile deceiver on the verge of escaping his reach, but not there yet. Not quite. Dietrich could still do something to stop him.
Would Dietrich shout? Would he shoot? Would he stop Reed with a black-gloved hand, using his power as a Stasi officer to mete out vengeance on a traitor to the CIA? Would he detain him or ask him for papers or call in a dozen other soldiers, 100 to stop Reed from crossing the border? Doing so might start a war. Would he start one to save his own country? To save his partner, Lisa? Or would he simply watch, helpless, as the traitor escaped? Reed wanted things too. He wanted to grab Dietrich, to pull him toward the far side of the wall, to tell him that this was his chance, maybe his last chance, to come back home and live a real life again. To drop the pretense and the paranoia and the brutal moral compromise that came from the life of a double agent. To tell him that he'd served the country well. And that with 40 more steps, maybe only 30, he could be over the line and free. Reed could save this man's life. Unless Dietrich's position, like Davis had said, was too important to lose. Unless he decided to stay. If Reed talked to him and he didn't come, Dietrich would have to answer to his Stasi bosses, men who already suspected him enough to feed him false intel as a trap. He'd be marked as a traitor and surveilled or questioned or killed. On the other hand, if Dietrich tried to stop Reed, a platoon of American soldiers with 10 heavy tanks and 3 armored personnel carriers would come down on him like the wrath of God. And 1,000 more tanks behind them, with 10,000 more soldiers and planes and boats and guns and the terrifying specter of atomic bombs. A word from one of them might kill the other. A word from the other might kill the whole world. The soldier behind Reed bumped him, and he realized that the eternity of indecision he just experienced had only been a fraction of a moment. The world was still turning. The men were still walking. Reed walked with them, but he kept his eyes on Longshore, and Longshore kept his eyes on him, and the man's face was a maelstrom of fear and anger and suspicion and despair. He wanted to act. Reed wanted to act. But the machine was in motion, and they couldn't stop it, and they couldn't jump off. Reed kept walking, and Longshore kept staring, and everyone and no one got exactly what they wanted. "Welcome home," said the soldier. They were through the checkpoint, across the wall in West Berlin. "Glad we got you back."
"Yeah,"
said Reed, looking back into the east. Longshore had disappeared.
"6:10 p.m. West Berlin. The western side of the wall was every bit as chaotic as the east, with soldiers and police and tanks and gawkers. Snipers crouched on rooftops, and every brick corner and outcrop had become a machine gun nest. Reed hobbled toward the nearest American officer.
"I need a phone."
The man frowned at him.
"Where did you come from?"
"I'm a CIA intelligence officer returning from a botched mission on the other side. I need to call my section chief now."
"Do you have ID?"
"Do you think undercover agents carry ID? Just let me call my boss. He can explain everything."
The officer pointed at one of the soldiers who brought Reed through the checkpoint.
"Take him over there and sit on him until I have time to deal with this. The rest of you with me. I want every eye watching these commies like they were skin flicks, you hear me? Let's move!"
The officer left with the small group of soldiers jogging toward the wall. The last soldier pointed Reed toward a small cafe on the left, which the army had turned into a makeshift control center. Reed limped into it, collapsed into a chair, and gasped for breath.
Are you okay, sir?
I'll be fine, said Reed. Can I use the phone?
Not right now, sir. We have to wait for orders.
Reed nodded. It had been worth a shot. But he didn't have time to wait. He needed to leave, and he needed to do it now. Moritz Platz was only a few blocks away, longer than he wanted to walk on this foot, but still reachable in an emergency. And this was definitely an emergency. He just needed to get rid of his guard.
How about a medic?
Reed asked, and bent down toward his foot. The soldier looked worried.
Are you injured?
Reed clenched his teeth, raised his leg, and pulled off Pollard's boot in a long, agonizing motion. The bandage had held fairly well. This wasn't the first time, Reed thought, that Pollard had wrapped a wound. But blood had still seeped through it, and the cloth bore a dark red stain and the strong stench of copper. The young soldier's eyes went wide, and he swallowed as he backed toward the door.
Of course, sir. I'll be right back, sir.
The soldier ran back into the street, and Reed slid his foot back into the boot with a pained grunt, clamping it down again before it swelled too much to fit.
Are you okay?
Asked one of the other officers in the control center.
Have they started shooting?
This is from last night, said Reed, climbing to his feet. He clutched the cane like a lifeline.
Tell that soldier I couldn't wait.
He limped toward the back of the cafe, and nobody tried to stop him. They were in a crisis with bigger problems than one wounded man. Reed slipped through the kitchen and into the alley beyond, then hobbled as fast as he could around the nearest corner. He forced himself to hobble faster, air hissing between his teeth as he bit down against the pain in his foot, racing to yet another corner. How long did he have? How quickly would the soldier find a medic and return? Reed thought about just stopping, sitting down and letting them find him, letting the medic give him drugs for his injury and take him to a hospital. It would be so easy and feel so good. But he couldn't. He had things to do. Reed grunted again, almost a roar of defiance, and made it to the end of the street. He ducked around the corner and leaned against the wall, ignoring the questioning looks of the other people on the street. A police car went screaming past, sirens wailing, but it wasn't looking for him. He listened for running feet behind him, but heard nothing. He closed his eyes, breathing deeply, refocusing his mind against the pain. Where was he? He opened his eyes again and found himself standing in front of a dry cleaner's storefront. Did they have a phone? A flash of movement caught his eye, a bright beige car with a yellow sign on the roof, and he practically threw himself into the street, waving frantically for the taxi that was passing by. It stopped, and he climbed in with relief.
Prinzenstrasse 93,
he said, without even the presence of mind to say the number in German.
You are American?
The cab driver asked as he pulled back into traffic.
You are okay?
Yes, he said.
The cab turned a corner, driving right past the young soldier as he scanned the street. Reed ducked low in the taxi, and the soldier missed him completely.
Are you okay?
The driver asked again, glancing into the back seat.
I'm with the CIA, said Reed.
They were on Kochstrasse, driving east. After the first half block, he sat up straight again.
As soon as you drop me off, I need you to go directly to the police and send them to the same address. Can you do that?
The police or the American base?
Either,
said Reed, watching out the window.
Though I have a feeling you're going to choose the police.
The road curved, becoming Oranienstrasse. He could see Moritz Platz just a few blocks ahead.
Why the police? Asked the driver. What's going on? Are you with the military? Is there going to be a war?
I'm with the CIA,
said Reed again, and then, thinking the driver might not know what that is.
The BND. I'm a spy.
A spy!
Shouted the driver. He reached Moritzplatz, a massive intersection filled with a wide traffic circle, and turned right onto Prinzenstrasse.
What's going on?
I just escaped from East Berlin about 5 minutes ago, said Reed.
Stop here.
Number 93 was on the next block, but it was all apartments, and he needed a phone.
This gas station.
East Berlin, but...
he spluttered, searching for the words.
What's going on? Why do you need the police?
The car stopped and Reed got out.
Because I don't have anything to pay you with, said Reed. Prinzenstrasse 93, every policeman you can find, go!
He banged his hand on the top of the taxi, then turned and hobbled toward the gas station while the cab driver shouted behind him. Reed ignored him and pushed open the door with his shoulder. His feet burned at every step.
I need your phone!
Kein Englisch, said the clerk, eyes fixed on the radio.
He was listening to live coverage of the standoff barely seven blocks away.
Dein Telefon, said Reed.
Yes!
The clerk looked at him as if realizing for the first time that he was talking to an American, which as often as not meant military. His question was the same as the driver's.
Is there going to be a war?
Not if I can stop it, said Reed, exaggerating only slightly. Give me your phone. The clerk pulled a fat rotary phone from his desk and set it on the counter. Reed thanked him, picked up the receiver, and dialed the cabin.
Hello,
said Gisela.
It's Wallace Reed, said Reed. I need to talk to Davis immediately.
Wally,
Gisela shouted.
What? How are you? Where are you? You're across the wall.
I'm back now,
said Reed, turning to face the window. Prinzenstrasse had only a few people, but all of them were nervous, jittery, walking quickly or clustered around a TV screen in a shop window across the street, watching their greatest fears broadcast live.
Can I get the chief, please?
He's gone, said Gisela. Everyone's gone. He has them all combing the streets for Johannes.
He escaped? He left just a few minutes into your message, said Gisela.
We were all so shocked by it, staring across the road, that we didn't even see him slip out.
Had Ostertag cracked the code? Reed hadn't expected that, though Ostertag had always been a capable cryptographer. Or had he simply put two and two together, assumed he'd been discovered, and stepped out just in case? Reed shook his head. It didn't matter why he'd left, only how quickly they could catch him again. Ostertag's guilt was the only proof of Reed's innocence.
But Lisa translated the code, asked Reed. You know that he's a traitor.
We do, said Gisela. And Bettina is in custody. Wally, is she a traitor too?
I don't know, said Reed.
Ostertag's contact told him to use her, but I don't know if she was a willing participant or a hapless mark. Is she okay?
She was weeping, said Gisela. But the security guards have her isolated now. I don't know how she's doing at the moment.
Scheiße, said the clerk, and Reed looked up.
What? They are raising their weapons, said the clerk. Do something!
Gisela!
Reed shouted in the phone.
I found Ostertag's handler. Johannes might be with him. Is there anyone in the cabin at all? Do you have any way of contacting them?
They're all gone,
Gisela insisted.
I don't know where they are.
Find them,
said Reed, or find anyone else that you can. Cops, soldiers, the State Department, whoever. Send them to Prinzenstrasse 93D.
Wait!
Looking out the window, Reed's jaw fell open. Johannes Ostertag was walking right past the gas station, his collar turned up and his hat pulled low over his eyes. Before he had time to make a conscious decision, Reed found himself turning and crouching on his one good leg, trying to stay out of sight.
He's right here,
he whispered into the phone. Walking north on Prinzenstrasse toward Moritzplatz. He's left his safe house, probably trying to get to the train station.
Get him, said Gisela.
I can barely walk, said Reed.
He glanced out the window again, just catching the tiniest glimpse of Ostertag's back as he walked out of view.
I'm injured and I'm unarmed. I need backup. I'll send whoever I can, said Gisela. Follow him!
I'll try,
said Reed, and hung up the phone. He limped to the window and peeked out onto the street.
You need help? Asked the clerk.
Stay here, said Reed.
I'm chasing a federal fugitive, probably armed.
He opened the door and said it again.
Stay here!
The street was full of nervous energy, people hurrying through the city as if afraid to be caught in the sun. Reed gripped his cane tightly and limped forward as fast as he could go. Ostertag was about 30 yards ahead, walking quickly. Reed pulled his own hat low as well, hoping that it and the limp and the unfamiliar clothes would disguise him if Ostertag turned around. He fixed his eyes on the man's back and tried not to lose him in the crowd. All around them, people were running or turning or stopping cold, moving as if they didn't know what to do, run toward the wall or away from it, go to work or go home, stay inside or outside. There were tanks in the city and maybe a war, and the terrified indecision had gone past frozen into frantic chaos. People ran one direction, only to stop, think, and run off in another. Mothers with children jogged past him, headed home. Others piled their families into cars, probably thinking that the best thing to do was to flee. But there was nowhere to go. West Berlin was an island in the middle of the GDR. There was no way out for anyone. Only Ostertag and Reed moved with purpose, heads down, never wavering, straight toward the train station. As he moved through the crowd, Reed heard whispers and muttered warnings all around him.
They're going to attack. There's going to be a war. The Grenzers are going to move the wall. We're barely a block away from it here.
They can sneak over it in the night and drag us from our beds. This is not their country, not the Soviets, and not the Americans.
They're going to drop a bomb.
Reed was falling behind, his foot burned, and his legs ached from the effort of moving out of sync. He pulled out Pollard's bottle of pills and swallowed three more. If he couldn't catch Ostertag, then it didn't matter if he overdosed or not. He hoped they kicked in quickly, and he watched Ostertag's back without wavering. For one brief moment, he thought the man was turning to the side, but he continued straight, past the railing, down the stairs to the train station, and out of sight. Reed gritted his teeth, practically dragging his injured foot, and hurried to catch him. The stairs went down to a large tiled room, filled with people just as agitated as the ones above. On the sides, more stairs plunged down to access the platform itself. Reed had to slow down on the stairs. He realized he was sweating profusely, despite the cold, whether from the exertion or from the drugs, he didn't know. He scanned the crowded room wildly, desperate to catch a glimpse of Ostertag. Instead, he saw several men in hats and coats. It was late October, after all, and couldn't tell at a glance which one of them was Johannes. He stayed a few steps up from the bottom of the stairs, giving him a better view, and as he searched the room, a face stood out to him abruptly. Not Ostertag. Erich Gunther Anselm. Anselm was leaning against the wall on the side of the room, facing toward Reed and deep in conversation with another man. The stranger had his back to Reed, so he couldn't recognize him, but he could tell at least that it wasn't Johannes. Reed stared, dumbstruck, wondering if this was why Ostertag had been coming to the train station. Was he trying to make contact with a fellow Stasi operative? Or was this purely a coincidence? He watched in fascination, and his eye caught the movement of a figure in the crowd. A hat and trench coat man suddenly changing course, weaving through the mass of people in a direct line for Anselm.
It was Ostertag.
Reed clutched the railing, feeling a wave of dizziness wash through him. The drugs were kicking in. He watched Ostertag's back, trying to parse his new set of wild possibilities. Reed couldn't have overpowered Ostertag as it was, and now that the man had backup, it was even more dangerous to approach him.
Should he cut his losses and back away, or try to follow them both to some other safe house? And who was the third man with them? A meaningless civilian? Another Stasi agent? Sergei Sigonov himself? Ostertag had almost reached the pair of men moving directly into Anselm's eyeline, and Anselm's reaction caught Reed by surprise, not recognition, not understanding, but sudden, abject fear. Why fear? He was clearly not expecting to see Ostertag here, but why did his sudden appearance make Anselm afraid? And then the third man turned around, and Reed understood. It was Frank Schwartz. Gisela had said that everyone was out to look for Johannes. Frank, it seemed, had tried to use his brand new relationship with one Stasi agent to try to find the other. And it had worked perfectly, perhaps too perfectly, for the meeting was so sudden that it surprised all three of them. Frank's reaction was slow. He goggled at Ostertag for just a second, just a pair of heartbeats, but that delay gave time for Ostertag to fumble in his coat, scrambling backward into the crowd. By the time Frank reacted, surging toward him for a tackle, Ostertag had managed to pull out a pistol. A Valter with a long suppressor, standard issue for the BND. He fired, and the shot echoed through the room, not deafening, but loud enough to cause the crowd to stop in its tracks. The shot went high, cratering the tile on the wall behind, but the second shot hit Frank's shoulder just as he slammed into Ostertag. Both men went down, out of Reed's sight, and the screaming crowd started running in every direction at once. A rush of people charged straight at Reed, desperate to escape the gunshots by running up the stairs. He pulled himself closer to the railing, turning sideways to let the crowd go by, but they were panicked and careless. One man bumped him, nearly knocking Reed down, and as he tried to right himself, another man stepped on his foot. Reed screamed, but more from instinct than from actual pain. The overdose of painkillers was working at full force now, and he felt the impact more intellectually than physically. He was still dizzy, though, sweating like a racehorse and growing more nauseated by the minute. More gunshots echoed through the station, and then the crowd cleared and Reed caught another glimpse of the fight itself. One body was down, though he couldn't tell if it was Anselm or an innocent bystander, and Frank was rushing down the lower stairs toward the platform, clutching his bleeding shoulder with one hand and drawing his pistol with the other. He had a suppressed high standard, just like the one Reed had lost in East Berlin. Reed pushed through the few remaining people, fighting his way down the stairs after him. And as he rounded the corner to the next set of stairs, he heard another gunshot. Reed flinched away, but the bullet wasn't meant for him. Frank and someone else were trading shots down below on the platform. Reed wished he still had his pistol. Instead, he clasped the railing in one hand and his cane in the other, wielding it like a club as he crept down the stairs toward the battle. The platform wasn't as crowded as the room above, but it still had people, and they too were running and screaming and scrambling for cover. It was a standard platform, northbound track on one side, southbound on the other, with pillars and benches in a row down the center, directly in front of the stairs. Ostertag was using the pillars for cover, working his way slowly toward the north end of the platform, firing backward every now and then to keep Frank from following. Frank had stationed himself behind one of the pillars as well, looking for a clean shot and shouting for the civilians to get down. Reed hobbled up behind him, crouching low, stepping over and around the discarded shopping bags and jackets that the panicked crowd had dropped. He worried for a moment what Frank would do if he revealed himself. He still didn't know if Lisa had told the others about Longshore's accusation or what they thought of it, but this indecision lasted only a moment.
"Frank," he said.
"What?" asked Frank, turning to glance over his shoulder, and when he saw Reed, he did a double take.
Wally? What the hell are you doing here? What's going on?
Ostertag's a Stasi mole.
Yeah, we got your message.
He looked back north again, keeping his eyes on Ostertag.
Then Johannes confirmed it by ghosting right out of there before we could even figure it out. But how did you get across the wall? Twice?
Later, said Reed. Where's Anselm?
I lost him in the fight. I think he ran away.
Cover blown, I guess. Hell if I care, said Frank. Johannes betrayed us. He spied on us for years, and then he shot me. I want his head in a spike. He fired his pistol, tunk, tunk, missing Ostertag by inches and forcing the man back behind cover. Frank winced at the recoil.
Damn the shoulder!
Stop shooting, said Reed. There are no more stairways over there. He's trapped.
Sure he is,
said Frank with a growl, pausing to reload his pistol.
Obviously, he's not going to use those giant tunnels to get away.
Reed looked again, realizing what Frank had already deduced. The only way out was the subway tunnels. Ostertag was going to make a run for it down on the tracks. Reed glanced at the clock. This was the D train, the train he rode to work every day, and he knew the schedule by heart.
There's a southbound coming in about a minute, said Reed. If he jumps in behind it and runs north, he'll have 10 full minutes before the next one.
Where can he get in 10 minutes? Asked Frank.
The next station?
Everything north of here is closed, said Reed. These are the ghost stations. Nothing but empty tunnels for nearly 6 kilometers. He can't reach. And then in a flash, he knew what Ostertag was doing.
He's going home. Back to East Berlin. He's going to use the ghost stations to get back across the wall.
I thought they were bricked up. Some are only chained, said Reed. He's had all day to make contact. He'll have someone waiting for him, ready to let him through.
We've got to stop him.
Now,
said Frank, and raised his pistol again. But before he could fire, another gunshot sounded from behind, and Frank went down with a scream. Reed whirled, lashing out with his cane. Erich Gunther Anselm was standing behind them. He stepped back, easily dodging the blow, but in doing so, he stepped on a fallen purse. It slid beneath him, his foot moved, and he fell backward, arms pinwheeling helplessly as he tried to keep his balance. His hands clenched reflexively, pulling down on the trigger, but the shot went wild, exploding a fluorescent light above Reed's head. When Anselm hit the ground, the gun clattered away. He and Reed both lunged for it. But a woman huddled behind a garbage can saw her chance and kicked it, knocking the gun off the platform and down to the tracks.
Wait!
Shouted Reed, but Anselm jumped after it, desperate to recover the weapon. He landed with a grunt, his feet shifting in the gravel, and reached for the gun. Reed shouted again, but it was too late. The gun was too far, and when Anselm leaned to reach it, he brushed the third rail. Electricity shot through him, and he collapsed in an unconscious heap. A roar approached from the tunnel. The train was coming. Reed didn't think. He dropped his cane, laid down on the platform, and rolled off the side.
9!
Screamed the woman behind him, but Reed didn't stop. They needed Anselm for questioning. The information he could give them would be invaluable. The man's body had fallen away from the third rail, so Reed could touch him without danger, but lifting him was another matter. A limp, unconscious human was fiendishly difficult to raise or control, even for someone who wasn't crippled and racked with vertigo.
Der Zug!
A man yelled.
Komm der Haus!
Englisch! Said a woman.
The train's coming! Give me your hand!
Reed looked up. He could see the headlight from the train barreling into the station. He didn't have time to lift Anselm, but he might have time to save him. He rolled him over, flopping him into the corner like a fish. Was that far enough to avoid being hit? He prayed that it was, then took the woman's hand.
She and the man and a whole group of bystanders lifted him up and onto the platform just a few yards before the train hurtled past, horn blaring and brakes screaming.
"Who was that?" asked the woman. "What's happening?"
But Reed didn't have time to talk. He grabbed his cane and crawled toward Frank. The surveillance officer was clutching his shoulder with one hand and his leg with another, and a group of civilians was trying to stop the flow of blood.
"I'm fine," growled Frank, his teeth clenched in obvious pain.
He looked at Reed with fierce, furious eyes.
"Get Johannes!"
Reed pulled out the pain pills and gave them to a woman by Frank's shoulder. "Give him two of these, but no more.
Zwei, and then get him to a hospital. Ein Krankenhaus. As fast as you can."
And then he pulled himself to his feet, lifted the cane, and ran. His foot throbbed, feeling more like a dead weight than a limb. His legs felt heavy and hollow at the same time. His head buzzed, and his vision swam before him. He saw Ostertag standing by the back of the train, trying to squeeze through the mouth of the tunnel. The train had stopped early, leaving only a slim opening. Johannes looked up, saw Reed, and fired his pistol, but all it did was click on an empty chamber. He threw it, shoved against the train with both hands, and slipped through into the gap. Reed stumbled, the platform seeming to ripple before him, but kept his feet, reached the back of the train, and squeezed through after him. The first 20 or 30 feet of the tunnel was dimly lit by the train's rear lights, but beyond that, it was black as pitch. Reed saw the dim outline of a man sprinting away into the darkness and followed as quickly as he dared. The tunnel was narrow. On the far left, a wall with a third rail. The two normal rails in the center and on the right, a series of pillars separating this track from the northbound side. Reed's eyes adjusted slowly, helping the light reach farther, but soon even that was gone, and Reed was blind. He stumbled on the tracks and knew that he needed some way of staying in a straight, safe course. The right side was filled with pillars. If he tried to walk there, as blind as he was, he'd smack into them in the dark. Instead, he moved to the left side of the tunnel and kept his hand against the bricks, stretching out as far as he could, trying to use the wall for balance and navigation without getting too close to the third rail. He remembered the sudden, helpless twitch in Anselm's body, electrified by the powerful current, and stepped out even farther from the side. At this distance, he was straddling the second rail, one foot on either side. The ground beneath him was uneven and dangerous, heavy railroad ties interspersed with a bed of thick, fist-sized gravel. His toe caught the lip of a wooden tie, and he tripped, pushing himself away from the wall as he fell, trying to land as far away from the electrified rail as he could. The sharp rocks sliced at his hands, and the wooden beams bruised his legs. He paused, groaning, but then stopped and held his breath to listen. In the sudden silence, without the sound of his own footsteps, he could hear Ostertag ahead of him, moving slowly and carefully. Reed had nearly caught up to him before falling another few yards, and he might have crashed right into him.
"Johannes!" he shouted. "Come back! Tell us what you know and we can help you! We'll give you amnesty!"
Ostertag ignored him and his footsteps started moving faster. Reed struggled to his feet, blind in the old brick tunnel, and cautiously reached out his hand again for the wall. He felt it and started walking again, slower than before, but faster, he hoped, than Ostertag. What was he going to do when he caught up? He didn't know, but it didn't matter. He couldn't stop now. He had to catch him before he got away. The next stop on the line, the first of the ghost stations, was Heinrich-Heine-Strasse. It was only a few blocks away on the surface, but there in the empty black tunnel, it felt like an eternity. Reed jogged forward, his breath increasingly ragged, and realized that he could see Ostertag's outline just ahead. Had his eyes adjusted? No. A light was coming. He heard the roar of a train and looked behind him in fear. But it was on the other track, northbound and southbound, he remembered, shared the same tunnel, with a series of pillars between them. The train's headlight drew nearer, its glow growing brighter, and Reed used the illumination to sprint ahead. Ostertag did the same, and Reed chased him up the track. The northbound train passed on their right, shrieking past like a dragon in the dark. The light from its windows spilled out, still bright enough to run by, and Reed saw a quick strobed slideshow of faces staring out at them. Reed ran as fast as he could, but his foot throbbed and Ostertag was uninjured. The trader pulled ahead, and then the train was gone. The taillights faded into the distance, and the light dimmed once again to nothing. The two men slowed back down to a walk, a slow-motion pursuit of the blind.
"Just stop!" Reed called into the sudden quiet. "Just come back! You don't want to live in the East! We can keep you safe! I promise!"
"Talk, talk, talk," said Ostertag, his voice drifting back through the tunnel. His breathing sounded as labored as Reed's.
"What does a little bird say in America? Cheep, cheep!"
Ostertag didn't want to stop, and he didn't want to talk. Reed was too out of breath to talk much anyway. He kept his hand on the wall and his feet away from the third rail and tried to estimate how long they'd been running. He knew this tunnel too well. The station at Heinrich Heinestrasse couldn't be much farther. How long had they been in here? 3 minutes? 5? He had no idea. Time seemed to disappear in the dark tunnel, the same as everything else. And then the wall curved away from Reed's fingertips just slightly as the tunnel expanded into a wider, open space. The ghost station. He heard Ostertag cross the rails and scramble up onto the platform, just like Moritzplatz. This station had a single platform in the center with a track on either side. Reed started to follow, but stopped. Ostertag was already up and probably listening. He'd be able to hear Reed climbing and rush to attack him. Instead, Reed waited on the tracks, catching his breath and spoke.
"Why did you do it?"
"Because it was the right thing to do.
To betray your friends?
To save them from Nazis," said Ostertag. "The BND is full of them. It was founded by them. That makes the entire organization corrupt, including every American who saw fit to work with them.
The man who started the BND was a Nazi in name only," said Reed. "He tried to kill Hitler, for crying out loud."
"And I suppose that's enough for some people," said Ostertag. "My ideology is less forgiving than yours."
Reed heard footsteps. Ostertag was moving on the platform.
"We had hoped to convince Frank Schwartz of the same. Our agents were making good progress on that, though I suppose that's all ruined now." "It was all a ruse anyway," said Reed. "We found Anselm and we knew what Talon really was. Frank was being groomed as a triple agent."
"Ah," said Ostertag slowly. "Then it appears I am not the only one lying to his friends."
Reed shook his head.
"We didn't know it was you we were lying to."
"It's funny," said Ostertag, "that we pretend that makes it better."
Reed heard a lock click and a chain clank against the metal door. Someone was coming. Reed had to act now. He moved to the platform, started to climb, then immediately dropped backward, hoping the noise would prompt a counterattack.
worked. He heard Ostertag rush toward him, footsteps clattering in the dark, and felt the whoosh of air as his former friend kicked the space he'd expected Reed to be in. Reed reached in under the blow and grabbed blindly, catching Ostertag's leg and yanking as hard as he could. The man fell with a thud and a grunt, and Reed used the opportunity to scramble up next to him onto the platform. The rise in height was barely 4 feet, but Reed was so woozy from the drugs that the sudden change made him dizzy. Ostertag rolled into him, knocking him down, and then with a harsh screech of metal, a makeshift door opened. The stairs that led down from the train station above were opening, and light flooded the platform. Reed blinked at the sudden pain in his eyes, looking away. As his eyes adjusted, he saw the shaft of light from the doorway stretching out across the floor, revealing dust and debris and the droppings of rats. A line of pillars reached off into the darkness, just like in Moritzplatz. A man's shadow stretched with them, reaching out of the doorway like a long, thin stiletto. Reed turned toward the door, struggling to stand, squinting at the silhouette.
"You're here,"
said Ostertag, walking toward the open door.
"Thank you for the—"
There was a single suppressed pistol shot, and Ostertag slumped to the floor. Reed stared in shock, then looked again at the silhouette.
"You killed him.
You brought him here just to kill him."
"An exposed informant is of no use to us," said the man. His accent was Russian. "Now he is of no use to you."
Reed heard the distant roar of a train, the southbound D train, right on schedule. He looked at the man in the doorway and knew there were only two ways this could end. He started circling to the side of Ostertag's body, moving in short, shuffling steps, looking down as his former friend struggled feebly for air. Blood bubbled up from his mouth. He had been shot in the lung and probably the heart. Reed stopped his shuffle, bracing his arms against his knees in a pained, exhausted crouch, and looked at the silhouette in the doorway.
"What about me?"
"An officer of the CIA is of great use to us indeed," said the Russian man. "The one thing your friend was never able to give us was the identity of Agent Longshore. But you are Wallace Reed, are you not? You can give us everything."
"And you're Siganov," said Reed. "Sergei, I think? That's our best guess, but we've never actually confirmed it."
"You never will," said the Russian. "Well, I suppose you will, but you will be in no position to relay that information to the rest of the CIA.
He stepped out of the doorway and gestured with his gun.
"Now, come along."
Reed began shuffling again, each step in agony.
"Maybe I won't talk to anyone, but what about the train?"
The tunnel was growing lighter. The southbound D train's headlights were getting closer, turning the stark light from the doorway into a gentler, multi-directional glow. Turning the Russian man's silhouette into an ever-lighter image of the man's full face.
"You can come and get me," said Reed. "But every passenger here is going to see you. And I can guarantee my friends in the CIA are going to interview every last one of them."
He kept shuffling, kept circling, and now he reached the pillars in the center of the platform.
"Which do you want more? Me or anonymity?"
In that instant, Reed ducked behind the nearest pillar. The Russian fired his gun, and then the loud, bright train rattled through the tunnel. The same train Reed had ridden 100 times, looking out through the windows at the empty, lifeless platforms. Now he looked back,
a ghost in the station, and wondered if any of the passengers had seen him. What they would think of him if they had. A nameless face haunting the underworld. The train hurried on and the light disappeared. Not just the train's light, but the door's light as well. The Russian man had closed it. Reed peeked cautiously around the pillar, but all he could see were the bobbing dots of flashlights in the northbound tunnel. All he could hear were the shouts of rescuers coming toward him in the darkness. The platform was empty and the Russian man was gone. Reed limped toward the closed door leading up from the ghost station, but stopped, too wary to approach. He stared for a moment, then lowered himself to the ground and crawled to Johannes Ostertag's body. He found him in the dark, listened for breathing, and checked his pulse. Too late. The man was already dead. Reed found his old friend's hand, sat in the dark, and held it. Saturday, October 28th, 1961, 11:02 a.m., West Berlin.
Erich Günther Anselm got away, said Davis. He was sitting in Reed's hospital room, watching him intently. Reed watched him back, though he was still a little hazy from the drugs, authorized this time and administered by the hospital, but powerful enough to have kept him unconscious for hours. His foot had been cleaned and wrapped in bright, sterile bandages. It hung in a small sling raised slightly off the mattress. Reed tried to move it and found that it was still numb. He struggled to wake up more fully.
Anselm got away. Rolling him into the corner like you did saved him. The train didn't hit him, and the people on the platform were able to pull him up when it left. But they didn't think to hold him. And when he woke up, he slipped away. We didn't realize who we'd missed until Frank woke up a few hours later.
So Frank's okay.
Better off than you were, said Davis. Twice as many gunshots, but then he didn't walk around on them all day like a fool.
I didn't have a lot of options.
I suppose that's true, said Davis, and sighed. He sat for a long moment staring at Reed before turning his head and looking out the window. Options are in short supply for everyone these days. Reed didn't like the sound of that at all. We live in the heart of a massive machine, said Davis. The USA, the USSR. The superpowers make big decisions and take big actions, and seen from the outside, I'm sure it looks like the machine is moving freely, going wherever it wants to go. But we're not the machine, Wallace. We're the gears that move it. The Cold War twitches, and that moves one gear, and that moves another gear, and all we can do is move with them, or be crushed. His words were defeated, his voice resigned to a course of action he obviously didn't want to take.
I'm on your side, Reed insisted. I'm one of the good guys.
Good guys don't go behind their boss's back, said Davis. Not in this business. Secrets, yes, we're drowning in them. We have a million or more. But acting on those secrets in unsanctioned operations, risking the lives and livelihood of everyone in your office, that we don't do and cannot allow.
I may have stopped a war.
You may have, said Davis, and I thank you for it. He shook his head. You know what burns me the most? The fat, glossy turd on the top of this whole disgusting mess. Losing Longshore. Reed looked up sharply.
He's dead?
He's alive, said Davis. But what good does that do me? You understand the position you've placed me in, right? You told me last night, half delirious from pain and meds, but you told me, and it makes sense. Tsiganov gave three suspected moles three different sets of false information so they could watch us and see which lie floated down through the other end of the pipe. Longshore was told that you were a mole, and now if anything happens to you, the suspicion falls on him. I can't trust you, but I can't fire you either. I certainly can't kill you. Options, as I said, are in very short supply. Reed allowed himself a sliver of hope.
You're pulling him out?
Davis frowned at Reed's obvious cheer. That is not a good thing.
You're done with me anyway, said Reed, allowing some of his anger to show through.
I'll take my pleasure where I can.
Fair enough, said Davis. Reed probed for more information.
With him safe, your options open up. Will I be fired or fired at?
Fired, said Davis. Lisa, too. Just because she was smarter about her betrayal of trust doesn't make it any less of a betrayal. And you'll be debriefed to hell and back before you go, too, but that can wait. He stood up. Officially, you're hospitalized until Longshore is safe, at which point you will be unceremoniously fired. Unofficially. He held out his hand, and after a moment of confusion, Reed took it. Thank you for your service. Thank you for finding our mole. And thank you for keeping us safe from the shadows. Reed stammered.
It's my job, sir.
It was. And you were better at it than anyone realized. He squeezed Reed's hand firmly, then let go. I hope you get to do it again, wherever you end up.
I think I'm still happiest behind a desk, sir.
Field work is too much. I'll stick with cryptography. Not a lot of call for that in the civilian sector.
Computers, then, said Reed.
Same basic principles, I hear. Good luck. Davis looked at the door, then back at Reed. I'll leave you two alone, then.
Two?
Asked Reed, but Davis left without a word. A moment later, Lisa peeked in around the door.
Hi,
she said.
Hi,
said Reed. She stepped in slowly, awkwardly, as if she was intruding in a sanctum where she knew she didn't belong. She stood for a moment, hesitated, and then pointed at Reed's foot.
Sorry about that.
You did what you had to do.
She nodded.
You would have done the same.
No, I wouldn't have, said Reed. All the more reason to be glad I'm getting out of this, isn't it? I suppose.
Lisa stood silently for another long pause, long enough to fill Reed's head with 100 uncomfortable theories.
Lisa,
he said, but she cut him off.
I never answered your question.
He wanted to ask which question, but there was only one it could possibly be.
I do not love you,
she said. And his heart shattered.
I don't think I ever could have, she continued. Not before. Not lying, not suspecting everyone and everything. I was too paranoid and too guarded and too, well, too good at my job.
She shifted her feet and looked at him with a faint smile.
But now I don't have that job anymore, do I?
Reed frowned, not sure where she was going.
I've been in intelligence since I was a girl. It's the only thing I have ever known. And now I'm kind of looking forward to being free.
She shrugged.
Starting a real life. I hope you have a good one, he said. You will be sent home, she told him. You are here on a government visa for a government job, and without that job, they will not let you stay in West Germany. You will go home to the US and you will find a good job and, I hope, a good life. But if you ever come back, if you ever see me again or I see you, if I travel to the States looking for a job or to go to school, if we ever run into each other in a street or a park or an office, maybe we can start over as real people this time. Not agents, not lies, not ghosts. We can tell each other the truth, and we can see where that takes us. Reed swallowed. I'd like that. I would too.
Lisa smiled again, just a tiny flash, then composed herself, stepped forward, and offered her hand.
You are a good officer, Wallace Reed. And a good man.
You were a good officer too, said Reed. He shook her hand firmly. And a good woman.
Stay safe, she told him,
and let go of his hand and walked out the door. Reed listened to her footsteps on the hard tile floor, counting every one until they were gone.
Author's note. Hi, I'm Dan Wells. The idea for this book came to me when I was attending the Frankfurt Book Fair for the launch of my novel Blue Screen. I was in my hotel room researching something completely unrelated, and one thing led to another, and I found myself reading a long chain of Wikipedia articles about cryptography. The idea that fascinated me the most was the one-time pad, an encryption system that is both completely unbreakable and massively vulnerable. Story ideas started popping up almost faster than I could process them. And because I was in Germany at the time, many of those ideas combined with that setting. And because I'm a Cold War kid who keeps a chunk of the Berlin Wall in my writing desk, that got thrown in there as well. By morning, I'd sketched out the basic plot of a novel, and the rest is history. The characters and events in Ghost Station are almost all fictional, but some aspects of the book are completely real, including most of the locations. The cabin is my own creation. But the CIA and the West German BND did work very closely together, and combined offices and operations did exist. It is also true that the BND was created and heavily staffed by former Nazis, which caused many problems for a lot of people as the two organizations tried to work together against the Soviet Union. The technology that I show them using in my book is accurate to the time and place, most notably the FS7 transmitter and the RT3 burst encoder. And of course the concept of a number station. To my knowledge, no double agents ever used a copy of Kurt Vonnegut's Player Piano as a one-time pad, but the codes I built around it were made from an authentic copy of the book, of the correct printing and edition to be available in Berlin in 1961. It is also true that the Berlin Wall, which went up overnight on August 13, 1961, took everybody by surprise, including the Western intelligence community. Many people suspected that a wall would be built, but nobody knew that firm plans existed and nobody was ready when it actually happened. The wall itself evolved constantly over the 28 years that it existed. When most of us think of the wall, we remember what's called the Stage 4 or 4th generation wall. It was 12 feet high, was topped with a pipe, and was flanked by a parallel fence on the eastern side up to 160 yards away, with a death strip in between them filled with landmines, watchtowers, dog runs, and more. This Stage 4 wall was built in 1975 and lasted until the wall came down in 1989. The wall, as it appears in my book, is the Stage 1 wall, which was literally just a row of cinder blocks and cement, 4 to 6 feet high, topped by barbed wire. The area around the wall had not yet been cleared, and people could see over it easily, though it was constantly patrolled by Grenzers. In some places, the wall used pre-existing structures, like the apartment buildings on Bernauerstrasse that Reed and Lisa use when they sneak into East Berlin. You can find photos of these buildings, and of this first-generation wall, fairly easily on the internet. My reference photos and a ton of other useful information were mostly drawn from the book The Berlin Wall, 1961 to 1989, photographs from the stock of the archives of the Land of Berlin, written by Volker Firgutz and published by Berlin Story Verlag in 2013. Most of the names and characters in Ghost Station are fictional, though some are real. Werner Probst, who is mentioned in the first chapter, was a real person who really was shot trying to swim the Spree Canal, though the false accusation that he was a Stasi agent was fabricated for my book. The U.S. Chief of Mission, Alan Leitner, was also real. He's the one who was prevented from crossing the wall on October 22nd, which started the showdown at Checkpoint Charlie that gives the book its climax. This showdown, of course, was absolutely real and very well documented. The official communiques about it that Bettina reads to the cabin are taken word for word from some of the actual messages that Eastern and Western leaders sent to each other during the crisis. As strange as it sounds, the fact that soldiers from both sides were walking freely through the middle of the showdown was also real. A U.S. lieutenant named Vern Pike was able to literally climb up onto an East German tank, look inside, and confirm that it was in fact a Soviet tank manned by Soviet soldiers, which changed the entire tenor of the showdown. All of the other people in the book are fictional, though they represent types and categories of real people who lived through, and sometimes died because of, the era of divided Germany. My family and I were fortunate enough to live in Germany for 2 years, from 2012 to 2014, and I love the country and the people very deeply. I lived in Stuttgart, in the southwest corner of the country, which is about as far from Berlin as you can get, though I did have the opportunity to visit Berlin, and I fell in love with it instantly. It is perhaps my favorite city in the world, and I sincerely hope that I have presented the city, the country, and its people as fairly and accurately as possible. That said, I did include some intentional errors in my depiction as an homage to my love of Stuttgart, errors that, ironically, only a German would be likely to notice. Some of the German phrases and foods in the book are distinctly Southern and would rarely ever be heard or seen in Berlin. A good example of this is Maultaschen, a kind of German ravioli that is common in the South but almost never eaten in the North, and would likely not even be on a menu in a Berlin restaurant. The restaurant where Reed eats it is one I made up and called Richardhof, and that Hof on the end of it is also a distinctly Southern thing. In the North, it would more likely be called Richard's Eck. In my head, these two inconsistencies cancel each other out. It's a special Southern restaurant that sells Southern food, so all is well. That said, I do not doubt that I have accidentally included many other cultural inconsistencies, and I apologize to the people of Berlin for every instance in which I have presented you and your city inaccurately. Every error in this book is my own fault, but the things that I got right owe their rightness to a host of wonderful people who helped me along the way. Thanks first to my agent, Sarah Crow, my editor, Steve Feldberg, and my wife and manager, Dawn Wells, all of whom worked tirelessly through countless drafts to make this book the best it could possibly be. Huge thanks also to the team at Girl Friday Productions, who conducted the most thorough fact check I have ever seen in my life. I will definitely be using them again. And I want to give a special thank you to the many friends who pitched in to review the manuscript or simply answer my questions. Anya Hartman, Sonia Kanapik, Veronica Monte, Ben Olson, and Heike Westendorf. Any errors that linger in the manuscript are mine and mine alone, but they helped to catch and fix a ton of errors the rest of you never got to see. Last of all, and perhaps most important of all, I want to thank the many people who fought and spied and lived and died to help free East Germany from authoritarian rule, and who eventually helped to tear the wall down and unify the country again. This book is dedicated to them and to the many people like Werner Probst who gave their lives in the pursuit of freedom.
This has been an Audible Originals production of Ghost Station, written by Dan Wells, performed by Jonathan Davis, with an author's note read by the author, Dan Wells. Executive producers, David Blum, Steve Feldberg, and Mike Charzik. Editorial producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Kat Lambrix. Copyright 2019 by Dan Wells. Excerpts from Player Piano by Kurt Vonnegut. Copyright 1952-1980 by Kurt Vonnegut. Used by permission of the Wiley Agency, LLC, and Dell Publishing, an imprint of Random House, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved. Sound recording copyright 2019 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.